Our speaker for today is Clancy I. from Venice, California.
My name is Clancy Imesland, and I'm an alcoholic. But I want too much applause. They've used up most of my time with all this sobriety crap. I'm really glad to see such an enthusiastic group. Full of enthusiasm, full of zip, but I want you to know I'll take care of that. I didn't hear the name of the gentleman who got the first birthday, but I want to wish happy birthday to Bruce. And I think that's really, when they sang happy birthday to Bruce, I really kind of got tears in my eyes because, not because I'm a sentimentalist, but because I'm a musician. It was really bad. Guy back there in the yellow shirt, stand up and say, that was the worst singing I ever heard. Sit up. I like to give credit where credit is due. I want to welcome all the new people. Some people will tell you you're the most important person in the room, but you are not. You are the second most important person in the room. Because if I'm not in the room, it doesn't make any difference who is to me. And that's the way it should be for everybody. Your sobriety is the most important, right after mine. If I don't stay sober, it doesn't make any difference who stays sober to me. I want to thank Bernie and Tom, the O'Neill twins, for coming to the airport today and greeting me, whisking me off to Bernie's home. And I was starving. I hadn't had any breakfast. He gave me a dry bagel and some decaf coffee and stayed on the phone so I couldn't put in an order for more. I better watch my mouth. He was supposed to give me a ride back to the airport, too. Just kidding, Bernie. And I have a special number of you people I've met before when I was at the Unity Day and other times. There are two very distinguished visitors here that you've never heard of, and I never heard of, but they're very distinguished. They're two young guys who have just moved here from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And that's where I'm from, is Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And they've heard of me like you, most children hear about the boogeyman.
You better watch out, that Clancy will get killed, you son of a bitch.
Yep. And so they came up to me and, are you him? But I'm very glad to have them here, because one of them is studying to be a Lutheran minister up at Cal, and I think that as I told him, I don't know of anything that will better prepare him to be a Lutheran minister or any kind of a clergyman than being a member of AA. You learn more about humanity here than you will ever learn in all the theological schools of the world. You have a great leg up on it. There's also a young lady present who came up whose father I sponsor down in Los Angeles, and I only have seen her once, and that was after her father had been slipping about 9 years. He finally had a first birthday a couple months ago, and she came down for. He goes to some 7 o'clock in the morning meeting. Jesus. So I went down there just as a token, but I hated it. But she and I met there, and she's in a program in San Rafael, and she's driven down here. And I trust that you're sufficiently grateful over your father's sobriety to make some slight contribution to my material well-being. I'm sick of thank yous. How about a little something? But this has been I really wasn't terribly looking forward to coming up here. As Tom was saying earlier, I'm kind of a football freak, and I like Sunday afternoon football games and Sunday morning football games. And Sunday should be a day of rest. And I was in San Diego last night, and I had to be at a meeting down there, and I missed the Michigan-Notre Dame game, and it broke my heart. And I got home in time to... No, it's all right. I consider you people just my purgatory. And we Lutherans don't even believe in purgatory, so you know where you stand. And then I get up to catch a plane this morning, come up here. But I'll tell you, as in most cases of this sort, once I sat down and got going, I just have enjoyed this afternoon very much. I thought Tom just gave an excellent talk this afternoon. I thought Don't stop it. this continual applause every time you mention a name or anything. Let me read through the phone book here. Anderson, Carl.
Yeah, let's hear it for Carl.
What is this? Save your applause till the end. And then they, But Tom just gave an excellent talk, I thought. I've heard him talk many times. I thought he just gave a piece to me. Maybe it was my fatigue, but it just seemed to be one of his best talks. And I thought the panel on sobriety, usually panels on anything, this was panel on sponsorship. A panel on anything usually is at best, you might approach being a whole hummer if you get up that high. And I was pleasantly surprised. I thought this panel was just excellent. I know they were excellent because most of them agreed with the way I secretly think. So I knew they were at the top of their business. But I thought they were excellent. And usually sometimes women on such panels, women AAs, are more concerned how they look as women than they do as AAs, and they have a tendency to mealy mouth. And I thought both of these women just talked as AAs, and they just were excellent. Really? I'm just trying to do a wrap-up here, for Christ's sake. This is not a Horace Height talent contest where I hold my hand over each competitor. I don't know why I talk like that. There's something about San Jose that brings up the terrible part of me. I'm wonderful everywhere else. Perhaps you don't know my role here, I'll tell you. I don't know if you're familiar with carnivals. But in carnivals, they have shows along the midway. And first they put out something kind of flashy, and that draws what is known as the tip, or the mooches. Okay. And then they use that flash to turn the tip. Turning the tip means selling those mooches tickets to get inside to see a bigger show. And that's what we've had this afternoon. Tom O'Neill he kind of drew the tip. You all stumbled in. Then they had the panel sell you the product. Then at the end of shows, carnivals, you don't know, there's a thing called the blow-off, where you try to get them mooches out so you can get a new crowd in. I am your blow-off. So anytime you want to get up and just leave, it'll make it easier on all of us. I have to keep talking while there's anybody here. If you're not out of here 5 minutes after the drawing, I'm going to have that man sing Happy Birthday to Bruce again. I don't have anyone here from Los Angeles with me. I noticed I was quite touched when they introduced Tom to speak, and the people from Monterey gave him a rising ovation. Just, oh, Tom, Tom. All you could hear in my room was, bleh, bleh. Yeah. So I didn't have anyone here to stand for me. Huh? They don't stand for me hardly any place. Before I complete my talk, I want to mention one thing and just work it in here if I can. I used to drink. Okay, now that we've got that out of the way, now I'll go back to personalities. John, you tell a bad joke. It's kind of a funny thing. We lose sight of it sometimes. This morning, Tom, we're at Bernie's house. Tom was saying something about he's going to give some terrible talk. And Bernie said, remember, this is a spiritual meeting. It's on Sunday. And usually in a convention, Sundays are the spiritual meeting. Of course, this is not a convention. But it's hard to remember that Sunday morning doesn't make a meeting a spiritual meeting. What makes a spiritual meeting is a collection of three or more gathered together to discuss sobriety. That's what makes a spiritual meeting. All meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous are spiritual. Some are not quite as apparently religious as others, but all are spiritual. And we are gathered here this afternoon for a selection of spiritual meetings. And the meeting of Saturday Night Live next Saturday night will be as spiritual as any Sunday morning meeting. And all the meetings that you might go to tonight and next week, that's a good thing to remember, because this is a spiritual program. And probably the greatest mix-up people like me have when they come around here is confusing spiritual with religious. I think of spiritual, and maybe you do too, and I think of church, and I think of God. And in a sense, that's spiritual. But AA is kind of an odd place. AA deals with spirituality at a level that is not equated with religion at all. You can become religious here, but that is not a part of AA at all. That's a personal choice. Like if you become here and decide to become a car salesman, it doesn't make any difference what you do. The spiritual aspect of this program deals with the spirit of people like you and me. And the alteration of that spirit to do something that is almost impossible to be done. And that is to alter the world around me. It's a strange, strange thing when you stop and think. The purpose of AA, apparently, is not to change me at all. It's to change everybody and everything I see. That's what AA is for. Now, we know that is not actually, literally correct. There's something changing in me, but you don't see changes in you. The best way to measure how you're doing is to look around you. If everybody seems to be pretty well okay, you're doing okay. If they all look crappy, you're crappy. No matter how you can prove you're right, in either case. I found that I never heard that concept when I was slipping in and out of AA. I slipped in and out of AA for a great many years. And at first I thought it might be of some help to me. My first meeting, I happened to be in the Eau Claire, Wisconsin County Jail. You little whelps. And I wasn't in there I'm not a big gangster. I was in there for fighting a cop. Because at one time in my career, I went through phases of attempting to redress social imbalance and social injustice. And from time to time, I would see the right-wing fascist pig cops making an unjust arrest. And Captain Truth would step in and say, "You can't do this. We've been over there fighting in the Pacific against the Japanese to maintain some degree of freedom in this country, and people like you are not going to disturb it because you have some stinking badge. I'm here to tell you that." You have to have just the right amount of alcohol in you to really get that, to get the correct timbre in your voice. And you want to know something funny? On two or three occasions, based on my remarks, I got policemen to release the men they were arresting and take me. And I stopped doing that soon after I saw there was a sinister pattern being set up. But I was in the Eau Claire, Wisconsin jail, and I was just there over the weekend. I wasn't going to be there long. And my cellmate happened to be the town drunk. And some A&As came to visit him. And in a small town, you know, everything you ever do gets in the paper. Everything you get in the paper. That's why I live in a big city today. Everything that happens goes in the paper. And this one AA turned to me and he said, "We've been reading about you in the paper, son. You want to go to an A&A meeting?" I said, "Sure. Better than sitting here all weekend playing checkers with the jailer's dog." And So he took me out of there and he took me across the courthouse square, upstairs of a meat market over on West Grand Avenue, and I went up there, and it was just hideous. 20 old, depraved, drawn old pukes from that town, burned out old fools in their 30s. And it was kind of fun to watch him. It enhanced my basic feeling of superiority. And, you know, the same old baloney. "Friend, I drank and lost everything. I came here and put the plug in the joint, and I've just never felt so goddamn wonderful." I don't know if I literally heard it, but that's what I remember. And I was a young guy on my way up. I was making my move. And so this was just a kind of a laugh. But a year later, in a different city, I got in some jams, and people thought I drank too much. And I went to AA again. The same old fools, different city, same faces. And a year later, I was in a different state, and the heat was on. I went to AA, and I thought maybe it might work if I could find the right people. I don't think so. And just terrible. That town, they were preaching God to me. "Gotta return to God, son." I've always had the feeling that many people in AA are starved for God, and so they must seek Him. You hear people in AA say things like, "I've been searching for God for 30 years, and I found Him here." I never searched for God, ever. I've known where God was since I was 2 years old. He slowly circles the spire of the Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And he gives it to sinners. And he gives it to Catholics. And that's okay with me. Till you get to be one or the other, then you're in trouble. But you know, it's just frightful sometimes when you're sitting in a meeting just trying to get some established, some rapport, and some old fool to, "Aw, Sonny, we hate to see you fight God." Mm-hmm. It's all you can do to keep from saying, "Well, ma'am, you'll never see me fight God again." Boom, right there. Now you can just pick it up on the audio portion of your set for a few days. I was kind of a... I knew I had some problems, but there were problems not dealing with drinking. I at one time considered the possibility I might be a real alcoholic, but I didn't. It didn't scan, because although I drank like an alcoholic, unlike alcoholics, my basic problems were not drinking, It was sometimes, and I could bash drinking stories as anybody, but unlike alcoholics, I seem to have more deep-seated problems or feelings or things that other people didn't have. Over 30 years ago, I went into analysis to try to... You know, a lot of people in AA say you shouldn't go to analysis, you shouldn't see a psychiatrist. I don't know about today, but in my day it was all right, because there was a better type of people who went to a psychiatrist then. They're more sensitive and intelligent. Today, too many common people are going to psychiatrists. Anybody with money or insurance. And I found out a lot of things. I found out things I don't know how the hell I ever would have found them out. I found out that I had been scarred by the Depression. I didn't even know there'd been a Depression. And I found I'd been scarred by it. I found out that I'd been deprived as a youth. I didn't know that. Didn't seem that way to me. I remember one day this doctor was saying, "You mean to say, Mr. Muslim, in 1935 you didn't even have a bicycle?" I said, "No," but I got thinking about it on the way home. I began to remember I never had anything. Plunged me into depression. I'd watch my kids ride their bikes and think, "You ungrateful little snot. I never had anything." I'd have... mental image for about 2 months, it seemed like, of just a little brown-haired, blue-eyed, rosy-cheeked little boy standing on the streets of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, watching his little friends ride their bicycles back and forth. "Don't worry about me. I'll go into psychoanalysis later." I took me almost 2 months to remember that. In 1935, I never knew anybody who had a bicycle. Maybe nobody in Eau Claire had a bicycle. One kid did. We thought he was a puke, and we beat him up and broke his bicycle. But I don't know what psychoanalysis or psychiatry does for other people, but for me, it seemed to have the tendency to fertilize my paranoia. The more I learned, the more I realized I'd been screwed all along. One of the golden memories of when I was a little boy is when my parents were teachers, and I'd go to the opposite end of the state to teach during the Depression, so I could live with my grandmother and grandfather, and they just idolized me. I just had the run of the house. I was a little boy, and I just, I hated seeing them back. And when I got into psychoanalysis, I discovered that I had incurred a deep sense of rejection because my parents had rejected me and left me at my grandparents. I thought, son of a bitch. Another golden memory down the road. By the time I got out of that psychiatric evaluation, I'm several $1,000s cheap. I'm not putting it down at all. But one thing psychiatry does for people like me, I'm not saying that I'm not supposed to do this, but it does it for me. It gets you so you know so much about what's caused you to feel this way. That it completely blinds you to the fact you're not getting any better. When somebody says, what the hell's wrong with you, you can tell them by the hour. You know, I'll tell you what's wrong with me. They don't want to hear. I still see a psychiatrist once a week today. And a lot of people question me. They say, if AA works as well as you do, as you say it does, why do you see a psychiatrist once a week? And for a very simple reason. I've told him if he doesn't get to that Wednesday night meeting, I won't be a sponsor. Don't tell your dad I said that. I got into metaphysics. I got into a lot of things. I did read books. I did a lot of things. But what I was primarily trying to do was to find some way to relieve pressures I subliminally felt. To relieve emotions, to relieve stress, to relieve anxiety, to relieve intense emotions. It always seemed to me as I got older that my emotions were like other people's, only they were more intense somehow. More intense. They caused more frustrations and collisions with other personalities and hurt feelings. It seemed my feelings could be hurt by a look. And I can spot rejection 2 blocks away just by a... I'll get you, son of a bitch. Put me down. And on. And one of the things I helped to get through these emotions sometimes was a few drinks. That's why I drink. I'm not a drinker. I'm not some crazed old fool in an AA meeting. I drank 3 drinks and criminally assaulted 9 nurses and a nun. That's not me. I'm a guy that's been much hurt by bad breaks and misunderstandings. I have been granted some gifts that have worked against me. One gift is the gift of being intelligent and sitting most of my life surrounded by others wishing, why couldn't I be dumb like them? Well, they sat there thinking the same thing about me, unfortunately. Another gift that I was given, I always felt, I have been given the gift by some celestial being to almost instantly spot and identify crap heads. When I was young, it took me 2 sentences and a handshake. The trouble is, as you get older, they multiply. They just, everywhere you go, they're just more and more crap heads. In fact, I don't know if you, but if you are like me, you may wind up for your drinking days, if you have a telephone, and you get a telephone bill, you find a lot of long-distance calls on it. Because there's everybody around here is a crap head. You got to go a long way to talk to anybody, you know. I'll call that kid out in third grade, really, because he's in New York now. It was crazy. But I often felt if I could just find some way to redress the imbalance of these damn emotions. Because I, from time to time, I'd put on a burst of speed, and I'd fit, and everything would be fine, and go to hell. Remember last year, about a year and a half ago, I was up in Vancouver, Washington, at an AA thing. And these people up here were... I was in Portland, Oregon, is where I was. I never went north to San Francisco. There's no rest around here. There are some pukes over there. They were at the meeting in Vancouver. I just spotted them there. I've been assigned by God to follow them wherever they move till I get the message. But I was up in Vancouver, and one of the topics of conversation when I was there among some of the people I met was they were talking about their experiences with the Mount St. Helens upset. You know, there's nothing in the world drearier than hearing people talk about things that you have nothing to contribute to. Yeah.
Well, then Mount St. Helens, yeah, sure. Let me tell you some of the things that happened to me. Now, we don't hear this world yet.
But it was kind of an interesting thing that says that little by little in their towns, long way from Mount St. Helens, it'd get grayer. The ash would come down and things would get gray and their cars would get gray and the lawns would get gray and the house would get gray. And it was some kind of a ishy kind of ash you couldn't brush off. You had to scrape it or something hideous. It's enough to make you sick to even hear about it. But they talked about the graying out of their communities by this Mount St. Helens. And on the plane on the way back, I was thinking about that. That really is the great story of my life. It seems to me that all of my life, I have needed
intense colors. Not intense colors like in a paint store, but living. I want excitement and fun and colors and bright things and sharp and on and on. And I look for them again and again, and I find them. And after you find them, one day some invisible Mount St. Helens starts to spew it, and they begin to turn gray. And the colorful job begins to turn gray. And the lover begins to turn gray. And the car begins to turn gray. And the house begins to turn gray. And it just gets grayer and grayer. I don't even understand why Dorothy would ever want to leave Oz to go back to Kansas. Why would you want to leave colors to get back to some sepia-toned farm somewhere? You know? There may be poison poppies over there and a bad witch or two, but you can work it out. Just nothing to work out over there when it's Grayville. And most of the things in therapeutics I have done in my life are to relieve the desperations, I guess, I felt as things become gray. And that's why AA was always such an unentrancing place to me. Because it just seemed to be you come in the end of an endless gray tunnel. It's a gray tunnel where you walk day after day. Well, another day without drinking. And you make a year. Is there some kind of sunshine? No. A scrawny arm puts down a 69-cent cake with a candle.
And that's all there is.
It don't take long of that to say, this is not the answer to my problem. I don't want any more grayness. I can be good for a while. I was trained and conditioned to be good. As good as anybody I know. But I just didn't have any natural flair for it. I never had any training in evil. But I have a natural flair for it. So I can stay good for a while, but eventually I got to get evil again. And then I got to get good again. Because my training, I always felt, never made me quite good enough to stay good, but it made you just good enough so you couldn't enjoy evil very long. Even evil turns gray after a while. Everything turns gray. And you got to have some fun, some color, some vividness, some vivacity in life. And I discovered a long time ago that a few drinks has a tendency to enhance the coloration of my surroundings. That's why I drink. I never thought of it that way. I didn't go to a bar and say, I believe I'll have some alcohol to enhance the colors of my surroundings. I thought for more like, screw them. But that's what it boiled down to be. And I would start over and over again, and I'd fail again and again. And could not find a way to do it. I came to AA and got sober, like they said. But other people would get up and say, I've been sober now for 41 days. And it just gets gooder and gooder. There's only one thing worse than that, and that's the long-term success story. You know,
friend, I drank around the clock for 41 years. One day I walked through that door. The desire to drink left me instantly. I now have $4 million. Several different families have returned to me. And I owe it all to one thing. I put the plug in the jug.
I thought, I wish I were dumb like you, you old son of a bitch. But I've been cursed with the ability to think and feel. And I very nearly died. I came to AA as a relatively high-bottom drunk. I spent a couple of years as a relatively high-bottom drunk, and I became a relatively medium-bottom drunk for a few years, and I wound up as a low-bottom drunk, being 86 from Skid Row Missions.
And that there's a certain personal rejection when that happens. I was telling this guy, I said, you know, I'm not some run-of-the-mill bum you're throwing out of here. I've been on the faculty of the University of Texas. I've directed grand operas. I'm a great sports writer. I have ads appearing in Life magazine. And you're throwing me out? He said, I couldn't say it as clearly as I'd meant to because I had just had my front teeth kicked out in the Phoenix drunk tank. There is a credibility gap when you can't pronounce consonants. But I knew one thing. I knew that my case was truly different. And I had to find the place where there'd be some color. There is no color in AA. And I've searched for that color, and I found it again and again, and it grays out, and everything grays out, and it all gets gray. And the anxiety comes back, and the despair, and the desperation, and the frustration, and the loneliness. Not even the loneliness of being alone in a room. I can always handle that. It's the loneliness that overcomes you in the middle of big crowds of people where you're supposed to be fitting in. And just, you look around and they all seem to be having fun. I always felt, why have I, with all of my gifts of being able to spot crap heads, I'll trade it all for the ability to make small talk. I always felt, I'm the only one in the world who cannot make small talk. How are you? I'm fine. Well, I gotta go now. Or if you do say something, it's the wrong thing. Did you ask her about her mother? Her mother was just executed last week. So, if there's a sensitive spot, you'll nail it, you know. Let me tell you something funny. This is not very funny, but it'll kill a few minutes till the drawing. About 3 or 4 weeks ago, I was talking at a noon meeting, a question and answer meeting, where you talk for 30 minutes, and then they have questions for 30 minutes. You know what kind of meeting people go to noon meetings? People out of work. Philosophers.
Now, what is the true meaning behind the first half of the fourth step?
You know, that sort of crap. And we were near the end, and this one guy called up, and it was kind of a full room, but this guy in the back, nice looking guy, as far as I could see, said, I'd like to ask you, what do you do about anger and rage? I began to tell him, that's a very understandable emotion all of us are familiar with. And I noticed the secretary sent over a little note to me saying, you better cut it short. The meeting's supposed to end in 3 minutes. And so in my usual gracious way, I said, I've gotten a note from the secretary. I said, asking me to cut short my answer. And I know that many of you have probably got to get home to your apartments and rest this afternoon while I go back to work, and I don't want to keep you from it. And I said, you probably want to hurry right home and watch General Hospital. And there was a titter around through the crowd. Not Tom in this case. But a kind of a little laugh ran through the crowd. I couldn't understand that. I said, what's the trouble? The secretary said, the man that asked that question is the star of General Hospital. The whole goddamn panoply of television, I had to say the wrong thing. So I went up and snubbed him afterwards just to punish him. But that's the story of my life with small talk, it seemed like. And I went through life trying to use alcohol to help tide me through things. I never thought much about it. Because, a few years ago, I was listening to a guy's fifth step, and he stumbled onto something in his fifth step, and I almost resented him because I'd never thought of it. But he had somehow identified something that I never identified. All my life, I've been dealing with big emotions and fighting them and finding answers and frustrations and rage and anger. But the number one emotion of my life, I never identified until I was sober a few years. And then I had to hear somebody else's emotion. Describe it. It isn't a big thing. I've had a lot of big things, but the number one emotion in my life has always been, for most years, just a low level of unease. It's almost imperceptible level of unease. Just always, this isn't quite it. That is not quite her. That is not quite them. This is not it. Always kind of an unease. And alcohol rids me of that feeling of unease. And alcohol makes my life colorful. And alcohol gives me a little posture. Alcohol gives me some kind of a something. And sometimes I get in trouble when I drink because I have a tendency, I always thought, to burst loose because of the repressions of my goodness. I'm so good when I'm good, and when I'm bad, I just don't. And I had no idea that there was something that described the nature of my illness. I suppose coming to understand the nature of the illness here is the biggest single stumbling block of anyone's sobriety. I've been watching this for years and years. We get tangled up with all of the discussions of what things really mean and what the steps are on, and very little attention sometimes is paid to what is the nature of the illness. I've read this book several times. I was sober for a number of years before I noticed in that book there is an absolute word-for-word for paragraphs description of my story, and I never identified it all the times I read it. And it's the story of most of us, I believe. But you have to somehow be around a while before you identify it. At least I do. As was read today, it's the first page or two of chapter 3. It talks about the nature, the symptomatic nature of the illness. It says the great obsession of people like us is that somehow, someday, we will control and enjoy our drinking. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many of us pursue it into the gates of insanity and death. Not up to the gates of insanity and death, but into. That's why maybe over 95% of people like you and me will literally wind up pursuing it into the gates of insanity and death. That's why a number of people in this room today who are apparently feeling good will wind up pursuing it into the gates of insanity and death. Maybe me, maybe you, we don't know. It depends on how you're doing when the crunch comes. Nobody knows when the crunch is going to come. And the one thing we have in common, that somehow, some way, I will enjoy, control and enjoy my drinking. And then it goes on to say that we have apparent relapses or apparent recoveries. And we all are familiar with that. Followed always by still worse relapse. Until you get to a condition, that's such a delicious choice of words. I've been a writer all my life and I just love that phrase. It's such an exquisite choice of words. You get to a stage of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Years ago, I used to think that's how you got when you were drunk. You get so drunk, you just get to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I've come to believe in the last number of years that that isn't how it is at all. That is the feeling that comes right after you're sober again this time. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. You can't even think of a rationale to sell yourself, to say nothing to lay on the people around you. In fact, there's a lot of talk among... We talk a lot around here about suicides and feelings of suicide and going to commit suicide and attempted suicide and on and on. A few years ago, I was on a radio program for the AA Public Service Office in L.A. It was up called KFAC. This guy had me on a talk show for about an hour and a half talking about my story, then answering phone calls. And they listed me. They carried me as Alcoholic Al to protect my good name, I'm sure. But this guy was leading me through my story. And he stopped me in the middle of it. He said, Al, do you mean that you sent your wife and your little children to church and then you parked your car in your garage and turned on the motor and committed suicide? And that unless a neighbor going by hadn't heard the motor running, pulled you out already dead and beat on your chest and gave you mouth resuscitation? You mean that happened? Yeah, I couldn't believe this idiot. Of course, I just said it. You know, where the hell do you think I got it? You tell your story so often, it doesn't mean anything to anyone. And he had big tears in his eyes. Al, I've never talked to anybody who has actually tried to commit suicide before. And I guess I'd been in the AA too long. I said, my God, I never talked to anybody who didn't. You know, I know that. I never heard of anybody who didn't try to commit suicide. If you haven't tried to commit suicide, you haven't lived.
Yeah.
I never heard of anybody who didn't try to commit suicide. If you haven't tried to commit suicide, you haven't lived.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of talk about drunks. Drunks all the time are going to commit suicide whenever they get thwarted. But very few drunken suicides are successful, comparatively speaking. Some are, but very few are. I've often thought of pondered that. I talk to authorities in the field of suicide. I don't think they have any idea. Any one of us know better. But I think it boils down to this. Drunks commit suicide to make somebody sorry that they've hurt them or rejected them or treated them badly. And when you're in the midst of your suicide, you suddenly realize, I won't be here to see them be sorry. Yeah. And then you have...
Oh, no.
That's why you sometimes get called, as I have, and maybe you have too. You know. Hello? I just called up to tell you that I'm checking out. I've taken an overdose of pills. She's hurt me once too often. I wanted to thank you for your efforts to help me. I don't want anyone to disturb me at 410 East 14th Street. There are some drunken suicides, but I think they're accidental. They couldn't get the call in time or something. It's like in most big cities where they have a... God, that's funny.
I understand it. It's so funny. We call it a suicide prevention center, and they put you on hold. There's a busy...
Okay.
I was wondering, I don't like to play with telephones a little bit. One time in Dallas, another guy and I were near one of our rebellious AA moods. They had just put in an AA, or not an AA, but a dial of prayer in the city of Dallas in the early middle 1950s. And all the AAs were talking up to me. There's a dial of prayer. If you can't get a hold of your sponsor, dial of prayer. You know. I wasn't against God, but I felt if he ever found out where I was screwed. I'll tell you. So we worked out a deal where we were going to, just for cuteness, we almost did it. We got caught at the last minute. We got nailed. But we're going to put in a dial of prayer for atheists. Just equal time. Where you dial this number and nobody ever answers you. Very few drunks actually commit suicide. Most of them are considered to be accidental. Do you know when most alcoholic suicides take place? Shortly after sobriety. Shortly after being sober again, when you're immersed in a state of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization that is so strong that it temporarily induces a psychosis that submerges the basic survival instinct, which is the strongest instinct anybody has. And they don't make calls because they can't even think of any reason to rationalize or justify their conduct. I'd rather die than try to explain it again. Certainly that's an aberration, and certainly that's not very often. But that's when alcoholic suicides take place. It's a funny thing. I a few years ago, as most of you know, when I was had become somewhat successful again after sobriety and working in marketing and advertising, I gave up that career, and for the last few years I'm the director of the mission that 86th me. Get revenge on a long-term basis on those people. I'll tell you something funny about Skid Row. I can't remember the last suicide on Skid Row. There's hardly ever suicide on Skid Row. People die badly. They die almost every day on my desk. There's somebody who's been found dead in the doorway, stabbed to death in the alley, fallen in front of a bus or a truck, knifed. Just dreadful. But hardly ever any suicides. For one simple reason, I think, that they no longer have a great deal of emotional conflict. They have surrendered to what they are. Nothing. They have surrendered not to what they are, but to what they think they are, what their mind tells them they are. Do you know where suicides take place? It's where people have to get up every morning and pretend everything is all right and get it together and go out and face them and live up to standards they can't live with, and one day it gets so goddamn much it can't take anymore. When you give up, you hardly ever commit suicide. Odd thing. I'm sure there are new people here today who are wondering, how are you going to get around this? But
I don't know.
I got mine.
Probably the biggest thing I could tell anybody new or old today is for just a couple of minutes. I want to talk just a few minutes and get out of here. The greatest things you got to be careful are coming to understand the nature of illness. Now, if you are like me, you might have had misconceptions for years about AA. What is an alcoholic? That's the nature of the illness. What is an alcoholic? Well, sometimes it seems like an alcoholic is a person who's been in a lot of prisons and jails and hospitals. And I'm going to tell you something funny. Sometimes the very nature of our meetings drive people away that need to be here. And I'm not blaming anybody at all. It's going to be fault. But it's this. AA is made up of human beings. And human beings are more fascinated by bizarre things than everyday things. And, you know, when you have a speaker, it's kind of fun to have a speaker with it.
And,
exciting times. You go to hear a speaker and say, I'm just a housewife, and I drank behind closed shades for 10 years, and I raised 4 children. It was just hideous.
Oh, come on, let's have some prisoners. Right.
Let's have some excitement. In fact, you get into kind of a podium thing here. This must be the only spiritual program in the world in which speakers sometimes apologize for not having been in jail.
Now, I've never been in jail, but I should have been. Oh, swear to God, a lot of times.
Yeah. How is that about? We got an also almost upside-down social structure. 5 times in jail equals 1 penitentiary as far as spiritual credibility. Two state penitentiaries equal 1 federal penitentiary. The worse you've been, the better you are. I don't understand that. 2 federal penitentiaries, 1 state penitentiary, and 4 nut houses, and you can build hotels on boardwalk and parkways. Yes, James. It has been estimated by authorities, and I'll tell you that all figures in the study of alcoholism are incomplete or wrong. No one has percentile. The only one who has percentile figures are places who seem to make their living by treating alcoholics. They have ironclad percentile figures. You can't deny them because they're not correct. We don't judge. We just report. But it has been estimated by some knowledgeable people that over 50% of alcoholics have never been in a jail or in a hospital. Not in the hospital until they get to the end of the line. That is how you measure alcoholics, by being in jails or hospitals. In fact, when you stay around a while and your perceptions get a little keener, I've come to believe that the most horrible stories I hear today, because I empathize now, is not the runners and the bizarre people. It's those kind of people like the housewife, trapped in that house, having to look good every day, having to take care of those children, having to, no matter what happens, you can't run. You're stuck and it's just on and on. In my life, I run. I run a lot of times. But when you can't run, you really are dead. I sometimes just those housewives now, and people, newcomers are yawning, and I sit there thinking, I don't know how you did it. I couldn't have done that in 1,000 years. It's just too much. But that is how it's measured by jails or nut houses. You sometimes get the impression real alcoholics stay drunk all the time. I stayed drunk around the clock for 20 years. You think, oh, you're an alcoholic, you old son of a bitch. Yeah, that's right. I'm going to tell you a little something I discovered when I was about 5 years sober working in the field of medicine. I'm not a doctor, but studying the field of medicine. It is physically impossible for a human body to stay intoxicated 14 straight days and nights in a laboratory, to say nothing of the street. That's one of the great problems of being a drinker, is that you keep sobering up all of that. Again and again. You sometimes get the impression these days that you have to go to a detox center, to a hospital to get off it. Can't afford a detox center or hospital, you will go through the classic American detox. That is known as your toilet. I'm sure there isn't a person in this room who hasn't knelt in front of the old porcelain altar early in the morning and gazed into those shimmering waters, waiting for an answer to surface. And saying your morning prayer. Oh, God. And if you have any loved ones left at all, they stand outside the bathroom door and give you moral support.
Good enough for you, you son of a bitch. Why don't you go and puke at her house?
That is not fun. Well, maybe the alcoholics are people who, when they take a drink, they go crazy all the time. And maybe you've had several nights of drinking, or hasn't been. You haven't gone crazy. And, you know, I remember years ago, with the guy in Chicago, 30 years ago at an AA meeting, when I was slipping around, I said, "What is this physical effect I talk about?" He says, "It sets a cue for you to drink is to set up a terrible craving." So I went to a bar right after that meeting to run that test. I just thought, I better find out once and for all. You know? No craving. Thank Christ. Do you know what really makes drinking so bad? It isn't that you go crazy. It's that you don't know when you're going to go crazy. Drinking, for me and you apparently, the curse of alcohol is that it's like playing Russian roulette every time out. You don't know when you're going to win and when you're going to lose. You win a few and you lose one as though you never won any. And when you start out, you're young and strong. Some of us are click, click, I'm getting by with it. Boom. Let's not go to Rocky's Rockaway anymore. Click. As the years go by, it's just boom, boom. I tell you, there's a click in there somewhere. Sometimes you get violent. The sad, that's what they mean when they say you cannot guarantee your behavior after two drinks. It doesn't mean that you're going to suddenly act starting crazy. It means that nobody in this room, after a couple drinks, can tell us now whether they will continue or stop. Because it is going to look different. That's what they mean when they say you can't guarantee your behavior. So you say, what the hell is it then? Why would anybody keep drinking when you're starting to eat you? Why don't you just say, hey man, that stuff has eaten me up. I'm not going to drink it anymore. To hell with it. Anything that did that to you, you'd stop. But people like us continue again. Because we almost never seem to find out that the true effect of alcohol on 7% of the bodies who drink alcohol, different to the 93% of the bodies who drink alcohol, it isn't what it does to us that makes you an alcoholic at all. It seems to be what it does for us. Alcohol apparently does something for me that it doesn't do for most people. It almost instantly alters the way things look. It almost instantly alters my relationship to my environment. It almost instantly makes me larger and more self-contained and them smaller and less frightening. It seems to do something to fill in holes I didn't know I had either. But I don't even know it does that for me. I don't even know it. Because you don't know what it's doing for other people. But that's why you don't spend much time with new friends who, when you buy them another drink, they say, oh, no thanks, I'm starting to feel it. That's why you drink it, goof. When I'm in a bar at 11 o'clock at night with a people who know color, and I hear a voice say, hey, I said Reno! I want to hear a lot of people say, you bet your ass. I don't want to be around a bunch of people saying, why? It's so late. I have to be to work at 9. What'll I tell Blanche? Tell her to go get screwed. Alcohol does something special for me. It literally alters my perception of reality. There's nothing wrong with that. Except if it does that for me, it little by little erodes my ability to deal with reality. As I can make drinking more colorful, reality must become more gray. And the curse of alcoholism, it isn't an alcohol problem, it's an alcohol answer. The disease is known as alcoholism, and it's combined with this. Alcohol does something special for you that erodes your ability to deal with naked conflict. And the curse is that by the time you're starting to, alcohol is doing something to you, and you got to live in reality, you are now no longer able to live in there on a sustained basis. Being sober for an alcoholic. You know, sometimes people around the area say, why do I feel bad? I'm going to tell you something that we forget all the time. The natural state of a sober alcoholic is depressed anxiety. That is the natural state of a sober alcoholic. Anything other than that must be acquired. It must be acquired. So you begin to understand that maybe the function of Alcoholics Anonymous is not that I thought it was. Someplace to get sober and feel better. Getting sober won't make you feel better. There's a certain novelty of being sober for a while, but eventually the gray comes in again. It comes bad. So maybe you can help remember, I hope I can remember, that the purpose of the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous, of a sponsor, as we heard talked about today, of the steps that we heard talked about today, of doing these things over a period of time, is not to make you wonderful or grand. It's something infinitely more powerful. It is to little by little change the way things look to you, to gradually upgrade your perception of reality, to little by little degrade sobriety, to eventually begin to add color to your life, to little by little find that mixing spot of color called hope, and of tenuous belief, well, for God's sakes, maybe it will work. The feeling may go away tomorrow. I had it for a while, and I'll try it again. That's why sponsors, as we're talked about today, are so good. To get a sponsor, you cannot manipulate. I was interested in one of the questions, should you have more than one sponsor? Everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but the answer given was so grand. When I have two sponsors, I'll play them against each other like a zither. But I get no. When you have more than one sponsor, you don't have any sponsor, in my opinion. You got to have somebody who knows you for warts and all, and when you're doing bad, try to stay out of sight. That's Tom's theory. Not mine, of course. But I said some of the strangest things happen as you upgrade your perception. I am close to the children I didn't see for years. I'm close to my parents who I didn't see for years. The university, we were talking about that at the break, the university I was expelled from 1 month before graduation for my moral depravity. Today it's going to make me chaplain of the university for that, you know, but then it was a little different rules. A couple years ago they had me come back, and because of my work in AA, they named me their Distinguished Alumnus of the Year, and I spoke at their commencement. It was all I could do to keep from saying, why don't you give me my degree, you cheap bastard? If the best alumnus you got, you've screwed, that tells you something about the rest of them. All this is very nice. I've come to believe in a God. A God that is not colored by childish guilt and misperception. A God I've spoken to earnestly every day for years. It's incredible. I stopped thinking about it. The best psychiatrists and doctors I ever knew said I would have to take some form of medication as long as I lived for my emotions. And next year, if I survive, knock on wood, and don't get drunk, it'll be a quarter of a century since I've had a drink or a medication or anything for my emotions. And next year, it'll be 25 years for Tom. Tom, your previous speaker, got sober 6 weeks after I did, in the same place. Just think, if our roles would have been reversed, I'd have been the first speaker, and he'd have been the second speaker. Guess God knows what he's doing. Yeah. But the number one celebration of sobriety is to be involved, because when you're not involved, things don't change that much. Your intellect rarely will be satisfied if that's what you're trying to go on. AA is not designed to help your intellect. AA is designed to straighten out the emotions that warp your intellect and to keep the emotions flowing, to live in the world. I'm very happy to be here today in a room full of people like this. There's no place else I'd rather be. And I know that when I go out the door tonight, don't even have to look at the streets. I don't know if it's San Jose or what the hell it is. I have the tools to make that town look good if I use them. And to live at peace with the world. It can be Eau Claire, Wisconsin, or Chicago, or Miami. You don't have to be concerned where you are. As long as they're looking all right, you know AA works. And that's what it's about. I am most pleased that Bruce and the committee invited me up here. I am most happy to take part in this celebration. But the number one goal of all, I'm glad that I am involved with you. Not because I need it, But they all need it. And when I don't do it, they know it and act funny. So all we ask of you, newcomer, is dedicate your life to doing these things, not because you need it, as a sacrifice to those jerks out there. When you do these things, they'll act nice. And when you don't, they'll act funny. So let's do the best we can to keep those pools straightened out. Thank you.
God, that was great. Okay, if everyone could stay seated or stand up for a minute, we're going to have the raffle. Get out your raffle tickets. The first item we'll be raffling off is the Multiwith copy. And if you don't know what that is and you win it, then you can tell everybody else what it is. Clancy will be drawing the winning ticket. Remember, 8 from the top. The winner is 316-011. Come on up. What's your name? Carol won. And the next item is the archives of Santa Clara Valley, how it all started. The winner is 316-546. God damn it, I wasted $20. Is that it? There we go. Go. Six is in pencil. No, it was a real ticket. Okay, I would like to thank from the top to bottom, and we've got a couple things to do before we all take off. Tom O from Monterey. Our sponsorship workshop with Gail A, Pat E, Jack H, Johnny O, and Bud T. Special thanks to Clancy I from Venice. Thank you. And also, I'd like to thank, and if he could stand up for us, Eric and Michael O.B. and the Saturday Night Live group. And if you didn't like what we had here today, you can talk to Eric and Mike after, because they started this whole thing. We are going to read a part out of the big book on page 164, and I believe this summarizes a lot of what we have going on here today, and it reads as follows. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as we trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Let's close the meeting in the usual manner of the Lord's Prayer. Fred, you want to lead us? Our Father, be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven.
Give us today our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not to temptation, but deliver us from evil. For God is the kingdom, and power, and glory forever and ever. Amen.
He's coming back. It works.
Also, we have a birthday today.
Day two.
And it's Bruce H.'s 7th birthday. Bruce, you want to stand up? Happy birthday. Also, I was just informed...
Bruce.
Gong Fred, come on. Thank you. And also, Bruce, or Mike L. is celebrating his first birthday today. Mike, could you stand up? Okay, after a moment of silence, for those that wish, would you please follow me in the Serenity Prayer. God, okay, we have a disclaimer to read, and I can't see too well because my lenses are all fogged up here. Here it is. There may be some here who are not familiar with our traditions of personal anonymity at the public level. If so, we respectfully request that no AA speaker, or indeed any AA member, be identified by full name in published or broadcast reports of our meeting. The assurance of anonymity is essential in our effort to help other problem drinkers who may wish to share our recovery program and our traditions of anonymity. It reminds us that AA principles come before personalities. The definition of Alcoholics Anonymous is that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other so that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And we have John S., who will be reading a portion of Chapter 3 entitled More About Alcoholism.
Hi, everybody. My name's John, and I'm an alcoholic. This is the first part of that great chapter out of the book, Chapter 3. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove that we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. We are like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there has been brief recovery, followed always by a still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree there is no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish this, but it hasn't done so yet. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe they are in that class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. If anyone who is showing inability to control his drinking can do the right about-face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. Here are some of the methods we have tried. Drinking beer only, limiting the number of drinks, never drinking alone, never drinking in the morning, drinking only at home, never having it in the house, never drinking during business hours, drinking only at parties, switching from scotch to brandy, drinking only natural wines, agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job, taking a trip, not taking a trip, swearing off forever, with and without a solemn oath, taking more physical exercise, reading inspirational books, going to health farms and sanitariums, accepting voluntary commitment to asylums. We could increase the list ad infinitum.
All right. We'll have Mike P. read the 12 traditions.
My name is Mike, and I am an alcoholic. Hi. The 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems with money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is a spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Okay, collection time.
The following reading was not on the Clancy meeting. It was read at Tom O., and it's the multi-lift version of Chapter 5, How It Works.
We've got a couple of unusual raffle items today, and one of those is the multi-lift copy of the Big Book, which was the forerunner of the Big Book as we know it today, the one that currently gets sold at the meetings. And we thought that it might be apropos, seeing as how we're going to be raffling that off, that the fifth chapter today be read from that. Now, the fifth chapter, as it's stated in the multi-lift, is a little bit different than the one that we know today. The attitude and the point of view that was expressed in the multi-lift was aiming, I guess, maybe at a different level of alcoholic, right? In that, well, you'll hear it. You'll hear it here today. You may find it unusual. You may indeed find that you hope you want to win it in the raffle. Tickets are being sold over here. There's people in the crowd. And I've asked KC to read that for us.
Hello, my name's KC. I'm an alcoholic. Chapter 5, How It Works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our directions. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a way of life which demands rigorous honesty. The chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go any lengths to get it, then you are ready to follow directions. At some of these, you may balk. You may think you can find an easier, softer way. We doubt if you can. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas. As a result, it was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that you are dealing with alcohol. Cunning, baffling, powerful. Without it, without help, it is too much for you. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. You must find him now. Half measures will avail you nothing. You stand at the turning point. Throw yourself under his protection and care with complete abandon. Now we think you can take it. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as your program of recovery. Number one, admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Number two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Number three, made a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care and direction of God as we understood him. Number four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Number five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Number six, we're entirely willing that God remove all these defects of character. Number seven, humbly, on our knees, asked him to remove our shortcomings, holding nothing back. Number eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make complete amends to them all. Number nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Number ten, continued to take personal inventory, and we were wrong and promptly admitted it. Number 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our contact with God, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Number 12, having had a spiritual experience as a result of the course of action, we tried to carry this message to others, especially alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. You may exclaim, "What an order. I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after have been designed to sell you three pertinent ideas. A, that you are alcoholic and cannot manage your own life. B, that probably no human power can relieve you of your alcoholism. C, that God can and will. If you are not convinced of these vital issues, you have to reread the book to this point, or else throw it away. And thank you.
Sounds to me like the version we've got today is the easier softer way compared to what...
Today, within their first 30 days of sobriety, would you please stand and introduce yourself? By your first name only. Hi, Pat. Yes, ma'am. Pat. Yes, ma'am. Hey. Yes, sir. Okay. Yes. Anyone else?
Yes.
No? Hi, Eddie. Hi, Evelyn. Yes, ma'am. Hi, Kelly. Yes. Hi, Scott. Hi, Francie. All right. It's a tradition of the Saturday Night Live group that anyone within their first day or two of sobriety that has a desire to stay sober for 24 hours. We got poker chips. And if you have the desire to stay sober, please come on up and take one and put it in your pocket and don't ever take it out. Do we have any takers? Come on up here.